So the next section, I'm just going to get to the drink while I'm opening this up. So the next section, we're going to try to take a look at a case study. We've talked a lot so far about a theoretical standpoint on what things could happen. So what we're going to try to do now is to actually look at an example on if you created a cloud business and you created that to go after something of banking, what would that start to look like? And have put some of the thoughts from earlier into practice on what that might actually mean. And so I'm going to just with a brief introduction. So with a part of Foreman Center for Future Banking, which is a collaboration with MIT and Bank of America, I came out of creating that having just finished doing the information strategy for Bank of America. And one of the things that we realized was that banking was on the verge of fundamentally changing. This was, keep in mind, this was 24 months ago. And so we believed that there were the two largest profit pools in the world tied to the banking industry, being consumer banking and payments, completely dwarfing all the other profit pools, and that there were players such as Google, Facebook, AT&T, Verizon, and others that could, Apple, that could, in fact, launch services and activities that would cut across all these profit pools. And as Comactive and Attack Center formed, the actual disaster happened. The investment banks went away in one weekend, and banking did, in fact, change overnight. In roughly 48 hours, the entire landscape was changed. And so that, I think, when we come into this, what I want to set the level set with a lot of the folks that we talked to today, I've talked to the sidebar, have said, well, banking's going back to basics. Well, the actual basics could be argued to be fundamentally flawed. And so the back to basics that people are going back to is really just a stabilization in people's minds. I mean, the share prices are going up, things seem to be okay, you know, deposits are on the rise, et cetera. But the fundamentals of the business, which is consumer banking, roughly 50% of the profits come from punitive fees that are non-consumer focused. What does that mean in this new environment? So basically, banks get paid about 50% of their revenue for people making bad decisions. Every time you make a bad decision, you get whacked. The other portion of that funding that's made comes from the payment networks, which are under attack from interchange. They also come from things that are going to be under attack from some of the new legislation on unfair deceptive acts and practices. So all these nested corporations that share information. And I can tell you, when going through the information strategy work at the bank, you know, the Bank of America acquired 100 plus companies over, you know, X number of years. All the different data that's there, how do you pull it together? So when the UDAP legislation comes down on these large groups, they're not going to be able to comply right away. And that's going to mean that huge chunks of revenue get ripped out. So when we go into this discussion, what I want to talk about is it's just kind of to level set with saying that banking is under attack. It's going to fundamentally change. It already has fundamentally changed, but it hasn't gone through the iteration that's going to really change the model itself. And so when we talk about this, I'm going to talk about, you know, how, you know, money that was just serialized zeros and ones, this information about people's money, do banks make the jump, or do the new version of what banks become information about people themselves, or just people's money? And then from that, can we think about some of the digital corporation discussion about how you might construct a new type of a bank, a new type of financial institution that is more focused in on the member network? And you can almost say, well, you can just network all the credit unions across the country, and you would have that right now and have a pretty good attack vector in. But so what I'd like to do is we're just kind of go down through order. I'll start with Joel, and then hit Jesper, and then Gerard, I'd like to get your take, and then we'll wrap with Ray. But Joel, maybe if you could just, you wrote a great book many, many years ago, Death of Money. Maybe just kind of start out with some thoughts about that.
Okay. It was about 10 books ago. I started off actually writing that book talking about what happened in somewhere between 5400 BC and 3300 BC. In ancient Sumer, landowners were obligated to bring barley to the temple
And when they brought it to the temple, that was essentially their tax. It was held there in the temple, and if there was a famine, the temple released the grain. The issue that they had to contend with somewhere around 4000 BC or something is that their harvests were not always even. The irrigation systems that they put in didn't always work. Some parts of the empire, which is in modern-day Iraq, fared better than others. So not everybody could meet their barley obligations. And instead of actually coming in with the barley, some of the landowners started bringing in their chits, which were kind of these pieces of bronze stamped with their name or something. And they were good. Each of these chits was good for a shay, which was the measurement of barley, and this shay, then people started trading these shays, these barley obligations, and the shay turned into the shekel, which turned into the first currency. So the first currency essentially was a form of debt. Then a couple of things happened, and it's 2008. So you think about what's happened since and where we are. And when I was looking at some of these issues back in the mid-90s when I wrote The Death of Money, we were just a few years away from having decoupled for the final time the dollar from gold. 1971, August 15th, big day. We ended up essentially creating the system that we have now of zeros and ones. Before that, there was some link, some break on how much money we could create. We don't have that anymore. We just simply have a system where you can inflate the currency through various actions of the Fed and Treasury working together, and you can then bring it back down by doing the reverse. So you can essentially create and destroy credit. It's all essentially done in computers. It's the movement and so forth goes from one treasury to Fed, Fed to Treasury, Treasury to Fed, back and forth. The interesting thing that happened is that from 71 on, if you look at the volatility of the markets, you see that the volatility of the market started increasing as the decoupling from a real asset, and I guess Tom mentioned the difference between the financial and the real economy, and this essentially happened in the 70s. Before that, it was actually the financial economy that was the smaller of the two economies, and the real economy that was the larger, and the financial was in support of the real. Now it's completely reversed, and the financial economy is multiples in terms of transactions of the real economy, several multiples. So we have this situation then where we have a lot of volatility. We start seeing where the money moves. The money starts moving in different ways. Since it can be created in such an easy fashion, since there are so few breaks on it, the markets, at least in my view, and the way I started looking at it back then, start becoming like pressure valves, where you essentially are creating a lot of capital. That capital has either to go into your home or your car or some other prices and create big inflation, or it goes into the markets, and in the markets it starts putting up the indicators of stock prices and so forth. The financial world starts to grow, and that's kind of harmless because it's not affecting the prices of real goods on Main Street. So we found this great safety valve. We also found a lot of changes in the way the financial establishment started looking at those shock absorbers or those pressure valves of the markets, and they started figuring out ways that they could take that, create new products, securitize. Lots of creativity that started at that time to put that capital to work. And it was a fantastic system until 2008. And we went from about, in the mid-70s, about 50% home ownership rates to about just slightly under 70%. I mean, that's phenomenal. There's a lot of debate. Should we have that many people owning homes? I personally think it's a good thing. I don't see anything wrong with someone owning a home, and these vehicles worked. But the point I guess I want to get to, because it's very relevant. So you have the system, the old system started in Sumer, breaks down in 71. Finally, we have the major issues that that money and so currencies have to do, which is store value. They have to be units of accounts. They have to be mediums of exchange. They essentially break down on every one of those issues except as a unit of account. We have the markets growing multiple times, capital available, a lot of creative people. So we start seeing these new products growing. But we also had at the same time the emergence of what many people are starting to see are very perverse incentives in terms of what happens. And I could give you a quick personal experience. When in the early 80s, when I was an economist at the UN, we looked at and did forecasts on Latin American debt. We saw that the Latin American debt situation was going to blow up. Brazil, Mexico, other countries Argentina could not sustain their debt. We called together a meeting of bankers. We had about 50 or 60 major creditors come into the room. We said, you can have our printouts of our forecasts. All you have to do is sign your name. We made our presentation. Everyone left. Only one bank took the printouts of everything that we had. I went up to one of the bankers as he was leaving, and I asked him, why didn't you take our printout? He said, well, if I sign my name that says I know that these bad things are going to happen, then I'm on the hook, and it says that I made loans and that I knew the forecasts were grim. So the incentives there on the one side were to make the loans. Collecting the loans was a whole different group. They didn't care. They made their, if there was a catastrophe, a collapse, they would make their money collecting the loans. We're in the same situation. The incentives got screwed up. Second piece that is an issue to contend with is we had a group, very well in fact regulated market, mortgage market, securitization market. It was well done. But then we started having the rise of the independent mortgage initiators. In the 1980s, they made up about 7 or 8% of the entire mortgage market. By 2008, they had gone up to almost 40% of mortgages that were initiated. So we have this essentially unregulated group that begins to be the major force for making these mortgages. And they're making mortgages, the ninja mortgages, no income, no verification, you know. All these subprime, Alt A, all the different forms of mortgages where you don't have to give any documentation, and this is an unregulated group that came in essentially and made a lot of mortgages. They made deals directly with Bear Stearns. They made deals directly with some of the other banks. The banks then securitized these mortgages and said, "My God, this is great. We've got these. We've made this, we have the profit, they're not on our balance sheet anymore." And then the same banks went around through the other door, the other guys who were incentivized different, and they bought those same portfolios that had gone out the front door. So the back door is buying, the front door is selling, and instead of getting that risk off their balance sheets like securitization is supposed to be, they actually put them on their balance sheets. So those are some of the observations that I've had for the last 5,400 years in terms of how this system has gotten to where it is. And of course, the next big date was September 15th, 2008, when Lehman went down, and essentially the derivatives and all those that Lehman was holding on one end just got let go. And the system collapsed. So,
thanks. That's great background. Maybe Jessica, if we could go to you, just for your perspective on you know, it's we look at, again, kind of use cases on what, you know, this cloud finance 3.0 could look like and how it might disrupt kind of current models or be complementary to it. Also, just get your thoughts on what you're doing these days.
So I would, Freerest, which is a project that you said September 15th, I think it was founded September
16th.
16, okay. And it's basically designed to provide a more decentralized, more democratic version of the credit bond, credit rating. Not really focused on the investment advisement part of what they do, but really on the covenant formation, right? The people use credit ratings to form these covenants that restrict investment in the marketplace and therefore heavily distort the market and necessitate bubbles in some ways when there's a mistake. And so we wanted to see how could we eliminate some of the incentive problems and some of the market problems in the space that created the problems that we're now facing. And let's go through a couple of those problems and how we think that internet-enabled techniques solve them. And so the first is that because you have to pay traditionally for people to do things, Moody's and S&P have really had to charge someone to rate the debt that they've been doing. And they've done that by, they used to charge for the data, now they charge debt issuer for the right to rate their data. And because there's an oligopoly of only three agents really in the marketplace, they have a lot of pricing power. And so they compete not on price, but instead they compete on the quality of the product. And the quality of the product, if you're issuing debt, is a much better credit rating. Right, and so there's a tendency to inflate and bid up the credit rating. Yeah. And so, yeah, and that's just a not really an avoidable situation when you need to actually take some sort of pay for service. But we know now that there are ways to motivate people to work for free to do things if you incentivize them in other ways, and you can get workers to align incentives in new ways if you kind of like looking at Wikipedia and things like that. So we. I'll go through all the four things, and then I'll explain how Freerest solves this instead of going back and forth. The second is that there's a monoculture effect, right? And we saw this with the Gaussian Coppola problem and things like that, where there was a dominant idea in the marketplace, and there wasn't a good incentive to innovate beyond that. It looked like it was good enough, and that would just froze innovation at the level. And because all the information was coming from the same algorithm, and everyone was required to consume that information in their investment decisions, that pricing error that entered the market because the cupola was wrong necessitated the bubble. Those were the only AAA assets that were giving a premium in the marketplace. If you're restricted to AAA investments, that's what you have to invest in. You don't really have a choice. And so we need to create a way to force more innovation and foster more competition in the actual techniques for rating. And we also that there's a missing capability for incorporating editorial content. Right? There were a lot of savvy investors who recognized the problems and knew that, you know, 2005 and 2006, that this was going to be a disaster. And the only technique they had for signaling really was to short the market and cause a slight drop in the prices. But that's not, it's a very hard to interpret signal. And we need ways to, first of all, create more visibility for that, and then also to incorporate that into your credit ratings. If you believe that the market's wrong on these subprime loans, how do you actually get that data into a credit rating so that you can go ahead and justify your purchase of the bonds or selling the bonds? And then finally, the industry is just opaque, right? There are some limited disclosure requirements for Moody's and Standard & Poor's, but they're not very good. And the underlying product they sell is not transparent in terms of what risk are you taking on. A triple B bond is just a triple B bond. It doesn't tell you that you're taking on governmental risk or regulation risk or currency risk or what is it that's going to cause this bond to default. And so the underlying product is just sort of flawed in terms of actually constructing a portfolio. And so that's kind of a devastating analysis we think of that industry, but we do think that the internet has changed things fundamentally in ways that we can now go ahead and fix these things. And so what we've done is we're creating an open database, a data set of actual assembled financial data from all different parts, starting first with XBRL data and just SEC 10K and 10Q data, but moving on from there, so that it's actually trivial to now go and experiment to create a risk calculation algorithm. It's been a pain in the butt, unless you have a Bloomberg terminal, to actually accumulate enough data to do this in a reasonable way, which just creates a huge barrier of entry to experimentation. And then we also allow that data set to be augmented with subjective data, so that if you have a viewpoint on the data, you can upload to us some data points that are then labeled as from you, And I can then look to either choose to incorporate or ignore your data, depending on my assessment of your trustworthiness or correctness, or even just a scenario test. And then on top of that, and I think this is the real trick, is we ended up an open API, so anyone can publish with a web server, can create a new credit rating algorithm. And they were just in two calls, tell us what data they need, we send the data to them, and we get their credit rating back. And that credit rating is both a symbol plus sensitivities to all of the input variables that you had, so that we have, it's not perfect, the input variables tend to be coarse, particularly for 10K and 10Q data, but we have a sense of, you know, if you have balance sheet exposure or if revenues are the real problem for you. And then finally, we have a scoring engine. We think this is what's really going to create the competitive atmosphere. They're trying to create like a Netflix Prize-style leaderboard where all of the algorithms will be ranked according to their historical ability to predict, which has its own baggage, we realize, but it's sort of the best benchmark you really have. So you're going to get people really fighting to get the best ranking and ultimately, you know, maybe give small prizes if that's what's required to really motivate enough people to get in, but really allow you to go and see like which scores, which algorithms are working the best, which algorithms are working the best for the areas, industries, or sectors you care about, and you can slice that data set in many different ways to get a much more nuanced view of what the creditworthiness is instead of just getting these like monolithic three different credit rate, you know, credit approaches that are all from the same space. And yeah, I think that's basically the points I wanted to get at.
That's fantastic. It's a lot. So maybe just for, again, thanks on that. Gerard, you want to kind of give us some thoughts on
Yes, I would like to show you some slides.
Okay.
Can I ask you to where's the microphone? Can I ask you to where that...
We want to broaden it. The issue is really scaling up the company. Right? That even just expressing bonds is a non-trivial problem, and then labeling more risk and or even derivative risk, right, are things that are there's a larger metadata group, and we just want to get the community moving, give them a high impact project first, and then introduce these other.
And also you're targeted at kind of algorithmic approaches rather than at individual ratings, I think.
We mostly because it's again easier with some caveats. We have thought through and started to design a Wikipedia approach too, where there is a qualitative approach where everyone would kind of agree. We haven't quite figured out how to roll up that information into a final assessment in any way that isn't easily gameable. Because it's not you. I mean, the only way we have for people agreeing on risk assessment is a marketplace right now with price discovery, right? So if you wanted to get that information, you can go to the bond marketplace and get a sense for what that price is. Yeah. Anyway, but you could at least give the qualitative data around what was fueling the decision.
Okay. In the meantime, the Beamer is ready. I would like to give you a short. Introduction into the Institute, Swiss Design Institute for Finance and Banking. We started in 2007, actually, and the plan was in the beginning to go more deeper into the question how banks and clients interact, and the focus was in the beginning the private banking industry, but because private banking industry is traditionally a big business in Switzerland, but
it was,
yes. And when I finally realized what does it mean, private banking, I decided as a president of the research to switch a little bit more to the retail, because the private banking is more about physical face-to-face interaction than a computed, mediated stuff. Okay, who we are, I jump over these pages. maybe that's interesting because the STFB, the research institute, is constituted by different universities from Switzerland. This is ETH, University of Zurich, the University of the Arts in Zurich, and EPFL in Lausanne. Not that pretty much, but more or less. And finally, the University of St. Gallen, and we have an interdisciplinary approach. We try to bring people together and to, ask questions which are interested for the local scene, but also mainly from the perspective of the user. We are pretty much driven by the question, what is the user, the banking client, about, and not so much what is the future of banking, because I think the clients form a bank and not vice versa. So that's our approach. I switch to some pages which are maybe more interesting now, and the time is not so luxury. What we did already, we had developed some kind of applications for the iPhone. This is just a bit entertainment for us in the beginning. We made some interesting projects in the field of risk management. What we do here is to think about the question how we could introduce the consumer, the client, into risk, and how to bring that process into a understandable form that clients could perceive the action they take. And this is some slides from this application we developed. So our role is not the design from this, but the concept and the architecture and the educational approach, all this to bring it into form and to shape it. And this is a tool which will be used in the banking industry. It's not developed for one special company, it's developed for as a kind of a general tool to educate people before they invest and to make them familiar with what risk is and how risky their engagement is and what is the purpose of investment, for example. And this is a tool which is planned also to be on track while the investment is running, so you can always go back to this initial procedure and can see what I decided and what happened really. And so this is a kind of a new a timeless way to follow the client within a risky engagement in the bank, for example. And this is one thing. Then we worked together with the University of Zurich in at a tool, which is designed to explain more about structured products. I show you some in some images. And the speciality is that user can really design a structured product on a multi-touch table, which is also developed by our university. And this tool is not only about information, what is a structured product, but it's about the question how a user can experience the basic functionality of a structured product by designing it. So these points you see here can be triggered by 10 fingers, and so you can see the complex mechanism of a structured product and all the functionalities which are embedded in this tool. And this is first a kind of a prototype. We introduced that to the public at different exhibitions and public fairs from the University of Zurich and others, and people are very interested. And then the crash came, and today nobody's interested in structured products. So this baby here is on hold in the meantime. But nevertheless, it was a very interesting approach to have something, a playful application, which really brings you the basic idea of a structured product, and this worked very well. And here are some images. For example, you could also have a kind of an historic overview about the index here, and some explanation functionalities which helps you to understand why are these rates different, differ so much. And you can see here this example from 9/11. So people, this is what we wanted to show is, if you look at the stock exchange and you look at the reality, you can combine this, what a stock exchange is about, and what the reality is about, and then maybe we can enforce the client or the user to understand a little bit more about economy or some basic effects of economy. And this is a kind of a economical literacy we also try to bring in tools and applications we design. And now I have some ideas, not about the work, but about the discussion we have today. And this is a kind of a script from today. I tried to figure out what you talked about the cloud law, about all the aspects of law and technology, which is really interesting for me. And my basic question here is concerning can I say that law is a kind of a pattern, because we in the design world, we try to invent patterns to make things easier. So pattern is a way to reduce complexity, and I think like rules in a game, also law could be a way to reduce complexity and to help you in a way to understand society, the action, social action you talked about. And in my concern, it is very similar. If I think about patterns, and that's what I want to show you, and it's very comparable to what a lawyer is doing when he constructs laws, or a game designer who constructs rules, for example. The result is always a kind of contained or covered experience of something, of society, or of a game, or of an investment, or of a interaction with a bank, for example. And that's why I think it is comparable in a way. And I will show you, before I come to the patterns, some fields of interest we cover when we think about complexity, the complexity of the market and the complexity of the whole banking world now. And you find bank, network, media, social networks, money, value, alternative currencies, person-to-person lending, trust, game theory, and security, for example. We try to think complex in the beginning, and not to to make a kind of a systematic approach, because I think the emergent qualities of the future, and a lot of you guys talked about the question, what is the future about? And I'm not sure about that. What we try and what we do is to think complex in the beginning, and to cover all these different fields, which are, each of these fields is complex. What is money? This is, wow, a big question. Or what's about value? Or what is bartering? Or what is a bank, for example? And what is a social network? What is about trust? All these questions which came in today are so complex. It's really difficult for me to structure that as a designer and to say, okay, now I construct a bank, or I construct kind of a future, and I have all these different topics in mind. And I think the emergence or the emergent quality of this unknown future comes out or as a result of this complex thinking. And it's like cooking a bit. You know, we put all these aspects and all these different things in a box, and then we will finally find a way to express it in such an easy way that we understand and we can speak about it. I think the speakability of this future is a very important thing, and that's why we handle this all these different aspects of banking. But finally, I want to show you some one approach. I call it the banking pattern language. And this comes from originally from Christopher Alexander, who was an architect and worked a lot about pattern languages and patterns. And what I like when I think about those patterns about the future is that they describe best practices and proven designs, and they capturing well or good experiences. And what I really interested in while thinking about this this topic, law and cloud, was the question of how can I systemize the cars a bit, and how can I help, not help, but how can I find a way to get a clue. And it's interesting for me, and I want to show you that beginning from the individual action as a client, for example, or as a user or a human being in the internet, then I form in the next step after action and perception this ideas of pattern of interaction. In the next step, I have this organizational context, which is about brands, quality, service level agreements, and others. And finally, I come to this level of institutional context. And in these different stages or levels, I can find a kind of a pattern. For example, if I make a financial transaction, this is about institutional patterns, because it is about law, it is about a brand, a company, and it's about my personal action and my perception of reality and about my personal understanding of what I'm doing. And so the problem always shifts between these different levels, and this is interesting how we can find a way to design those different short snippets of action in this huge field of banking. And I constructed this language in these four different fields. I call it generic. This is about law, economy, technology, ethics, maybe about culture. The second one is about quality, accountable, secure, sustainable, serviceable, and many others. The third one is about perception. This is my point of view: awareness, knowledgeable, experiencing, stimulating. And last but not least, the action. This is what I do finally: transfer, land, lock in, order, send. And I think this is for me kind of a helping step to have all these different levels and these different dimensions of the problems in my mind when I try to figure out what these patterns could be in the future, and how we could bring them into public, and how we could find people to experience, to get experienced with these patterns. We talked about the ATM machines. This is a very good example, that people get used to these machines and nobody wants to innovate them because they work. And this is not very interesting, but maybe this one is interesting. If we talk about law, I found this manifesto, this cloud manifesto. And it's about user-centric, security, balanced, evolution, openness of standards, interoperability, philanthropic, transparency, barrier-free representation. And I think this is also kind of a source for a lot of ideas concerning law and prescriptions and rules and patterns. And this is quite interesting. And finally, I found one idea very interesting. This is also about the cloud and its visible and invisible characteristics. And I give you this pattern I introduced. This pattern, maybe it's called transaction, for example. It has some relations. And the next, the invisible characteristics, of this virtualization is this cloud computing about. And also the cloud computing forms kinds of patterns. And then we have two levels of pattern. We have this visible ones for the user to understand what's going on, to develop and to engineer usable forms of tools. And the second one is this invisible one. And I would say that this visible characteristics should transport what the invisible are hiding. And well, this is an idea which has to develop. But yes, and finally, this idea of enacting a new economy. For me, the question is interesting. Is it really imaginable that we all are banks and clients in one person? And what would it mean from this point of view? And
some of the stuff that's going on in India right now.
And then I made a quick note about this microscope idea, and I call it the behavioral microscope. And this is concerning the question of identity and how to monitor identity in the future. And I found it's very interesting to think about that, and I wanted to show you this. And well, I have one. Sorry for this quick flipping, but we have a project running now at the STFB, and this is called the Flow Project, and this is together with the, a big financial company in Switzerland with PostFinance. And here we think about the question, and we really make programming stuff and design stuff to have a kind of an experimental virtual lab, kind of a bank, where we try to figure out what does it really mean if we are all banks and clients, and where we can, for example, test this private lending things and communication between clients and clients and clients and banks, and for example, where also clients were able to establish a kind of investment groups and could really be more aware of, yeah, of a self-ruled financial life. And well, that's what we do. And sorry for the chaos, but
that's great. It's fantastic.
Awesome.
All right, so I think we heard just to do a quick recap, and we're going to close with Ray. So we heard kind of a little bit of history about a little of the history of money and finance and banks. Then we went into a way which the web and these new technologies are transforming some old problems and turning the notion of TED. And then looked at some very kind of radical thinking from the Design Institute here, which is fantastic. What I want to do is maybe just turn over to Ray just to close this out. So, Tim, pulling all those parts together in the discussion this morning.
Yeah, we're pulling it all together.
Yeah.
We're pulling it together. You know, maybe so what I'll do is create some urgency around why Bob Lohr is so pertinent and important.
Also, but nice. Thank you.
To various segments of society, but into banking and finance in particular, instead of borrowing and leveraging. So I'll throw out some statements, right? And it's not associated with my last employer. I've worked for actually three of the largest banks in the world. So you know, my comments are not credit to the banks. But so the first thing I'm going to sort of throw out there is kind of the death of the branch. Banking historically has been so grounded in kind of a physical kind of building. So where I think everyone from their own sort of personal experience, sort of banking, many more people have been banking sort of online, so we bank at the ATM, banking on the mobile phone. So there's this idea that, you know, a bank needs to have some kind of physical building that vault. It still permeates sort of the banking mindset, and it still persists. Banks are still opening up branches. I'm not so sure that that's going to continue into the future, where there's sort of these cloud capabilities. Merck. So contrary to that, if you go to rural India, you'll find there's a company called Zero Maps that has created a bank on a mobile phone. It's a bank, computer, cash draw, they use an NFC phone. And so long as it's a cell phone signal, they're in the middle of literally rural India. For anyone who doesn't know, India's cell phone adoption is somewhere around 8 million a month, although that's an old figure, so probably higher than that. And Zero Mass in 3 years has opened up 6,000 branches. These are effectively branches that all exist on the cloud. There's no, we don't see columns. There's no internet. Of course, the risk profile is vastly different, but their goal is to reach 600,000 villages in India and 300,000 people within a five to 10 year time frame. Each branch that they open up is a total invested cost of about $500, and they hold their holdings of deposits is somewhere around converting rupees to dollars, somewhere around $2,000. So it's not a very high risk profile, so they're not worried about theft. The reason why that was initiated is because the Indian government gives out these disbursements of money to farmers, and the cost of the cash, the cost of distributing the rupees, is actually very, very high. Right? So they were highly motivated to come up with some means of not having to distribute the cash. Right? So we have, and Julius was talk about this. This is a case where you have interesting innovation that's using the capability that was arrived in the developed world, right? It's being in the developing world. And it's kind of challenging the notion of, while in the developed world, we're still opening up branches, right? One of my previous employers had over 6,000 branches. The other employers that work for other banks, have equal. Instead of challenging that, right, going forward, in particular, because you have the emergency mobile payment and those sorts of things. So I think, Gerard and I, over lunch, were talking about what is the new interaction model between the customer and the bank when the bank, along with kind of this person that you go to eat and build, and are the interfaces that you have on the web and your mobile phone, are they adequate, or are they just basically rehashing what you have with the ATM and lots of mobile phones? Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a different relationship that people want to have with the money that they can access, not so much banking services, but what it means to their life when they use those resources for, and having it connect more directly to those set of resources. Kind of coupled with that is you have also this undercurrent of most of our focus is on the very large banks that have gotten even larger, right? So Miami bank in the box, right? You get together with a Motorola, they can actually put a bank in a container. It's a fully contained sort of all banking services. You can get the license and get the money up. You can basically open up the bank and have all the services they provide for them, right? So a lot of it's the innovations in banking where you have this larger banks, which are sort of environments that bought lots and lots of banks, they've created kind of this cloud of smoke because although the front end is somewhat consistent, when you look at behind the scenes, it's Jeff mentioned it, but everything he said is also true of the other banks that I'm not so sure that those that kind of infrastructure at large scale size is kind of sustainable. So you have these newer providers which are sort of building the system that can provide them on kind of this cloud capability that's sort of emerging. And potentially they may be able to sell these services or enable the cell phone companies and other adjacent sort of retailers. private banking business, assuming that some of the laws are just, right? So, so there was that whole possible movement and changes in the future. There's a couple other things that I sort of want to mention. One is this idea that sort of deposits are protected. We all live with this idea that all money's in the bank, it's relatively safe. But for the most part, that's true in a practical matter, except when you're a victim of check fraud, right? And you don't cash the check. There's a check image. You don't get physical checks anymore. And I don't know about everyone here in the room. But I don't necessarily look at my checks every month. I just have, I'm busy and it comes in the mail. It's all electronic. It's all copying. So it must be okay. And the systems that are imaging the checks, they must be incredibly intelligent, and they would have picked up a fraud check, right? Whereas in the past, when you didn't have all the sophistication, but it turns out those systems that banks use to create certain efficiencies are actually have limitations, right? So they don't catch fraud. So check fraud, if you don't catch it, you don't catch it in 90 days, essentially you're out of money. This is for federal property, right? And no one's going to investigate that in 90 days. So if you start thinking of, and that's partly because there's greater and greater kind of usage of technology over sort of people processes, right? And there's greater expectations of people on the technology, right? But that, I no longer have to check these things. It just happened. The system should take care of it for me, right? Until you're a victim. Actually experience. So the same thing holds true if you have identity theft. Those things that those things that you take for granted as kind of protections when they don't work become they really erode trust and confidence in the systems that they're using. So existing, there's a lot to learn from the emergence of cloud computing needs to sort of look at those things that already exist that look like a cloud but are not really a cloud, mm-hmm. right? Not a cloud in the same sense that we've been talking about it sort of earlier. Such we need to look at those things that still haven't been fixed in these supposedly hermetically sealed systems. So one would think that by now, the problem of identity theft and fraud and money laundering could have been solved. It should have been solved, right? So now we're going to move lots of activity onto cloud computing. We don't quite have the legal framework yet to figure out what that is. We don't even know what the vulnerabilities are. But yet we have cases where things that look like accounting. Might be a smoke cloud, but it's these problems haven't been fixed on the systems that we already have, which are highly interdependent, are completely international, right. And are supposedly hermetically sealed. Yet they have vulnerabilities. If you compare credit card fraud on the internet, e-commerce fraud takes up 25% of credit card fraud is e-com related, it's not retail related, right? So when you look at kind of fraud rates, you start to think, well, I think it's 2 or 3% kind of on physical sort of card uses, and e-com is like 10 times as much. Right? So you start to think of things moving on to the cloud, and then the cloud taking on more and more of not just financial stuff, but now my own personal stuff, it's like my medical stuff. Kids stuff, right? Intergenerationally and internationally, and all the sense of question. What kind of vulnerabilities are we kind of sort of exposing when we haven't really figured out how to do it? The systems we already have. So I guess the last, two more things, or maybe one more thing, is just related to my first comment. It's kind of the took a cloud banking, so what would be the long tail of banking? What's the rise of the rest as for visa carriers or unnamed, sort of an underbanked population. Some believe that that's actually the growth of the bank. It's not the, not the population. That, you know, the largest bank in the world has 58 million accounts. There are billions of people on the phones now. And you know, I gave you an earlier example of those people actually getting accounts, and they're going to get them at least. So, you know, so you have an example in the developing world that potentially is targeting 300 million accounts from the largest today, accounts, and it's going to get built on sort of mobile phone infrastructure. But yet we haven't solved these issues that kind of might be, you know, banking, accountability and banking transparency, notification of transactions, and then you know, authority of the data, who owns the data, who can access the data. All these questions are kind of, you know, being raised for what it might be in the future for things that end up in the cloud, but they're the very same questions that we should be asking for those things which are currently on the cloud, for those systems that are supposedly immediately seen.
Thanks, Ray. Just to kind of summarize things up, I mean, I think, you know, the reason why banking is important in its cloud discussion is because I think fundamentals of the two largest profit pools in the world are going to cause a lot of attack vectors in on it from a lot of people. There's going to be a lot of investment dollars that come that go after that, so it makes sense that that could be a good place for innovation. I think the second thing is that just the complexity of how interconnected the world is now makes this one of the fundamental things that has to work in the cloud. So I mean, you have to be able to exchange value. So it makes sense that, you know, once you get that done, that a lot of other things can begin to come up around it. So with that, I'll close. Thank all the speakers.
Thank you.